given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up.
Welcome to Illuminations. I'm Renee Moran, and I'm joined by my co-host, Deanne Phillips.
This is a show about people making ripples in the spirit sphere in the 21st century. From ancient history to modern-day innovations, we are unpacking the stories of all kinds of interesting subjects, people, and events. We're going to the very soul of the matter, and we're bringing it to you.
Drug addiction, also known as substance use disorder, is an epidemic and national health crisis. According to the CDC, during the 12 months ending in May 2020, over 81,000 people died due to overdose. The National Institute of Drug Abuse reports that 85% of people who do manage to become sober will relapse. But this is not going to be just another show about how bad things are. This show is about an amazing organization called Shatterproof and what they are doing to help fix the problem. And in the latter portion of today's show, we will be joined by Dr. Sean McNeil, Clinical Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at LSU Health Shreveport. Today, we welcome Shatterproof founder and CEO, Gary Mendel. Hi, Gary. Thank you for joining us on Illuminations.
Renee, thanks for having me. Nice to see you.
The National Institute for Drug Abuse says research has shown that brain development continues into a person's 20s, a time that encompasses many important developmental and social changes in a young person's life. In your opinion, why isn't this more widely recognized?
That is such a great question. The answer is poor implementation of the science that we already know. You know, my career was not in healthcare nor nonprofit. And I was successful in the business world. I was raising my family. And my older son, Brian, became addicted to drugs. And he struggled for many years in and out of treatment programs. And tragically, we lost him. He passed away on October 20th, 2011. And in the weeks that followed, you know, I was very focused on the Serenity Prayer, which was, and really reading that first sentence over and over again was what kept me alive, which was, God, give me the serenity to accept what I cannot change. But as the weeks and months went on, I started reading and thinking about that second sentence, the courage to be able to change the things that we can and help others. And so with Brian in my heart, I took time off of work and I traveled the country for 3 months to understand what change was needed to help others? What change could be made? No, and as I did so, when I was done with that 3 months of traveling the country, there was one big stark fact that hit me in the face and really destroyed me all over again. I learned that our federal government had provided grants of tens of billions of dollars to researchers all across our country. And they had successfully created this wonderful body of knowledge. One of the pieces of knowledge you just referenced. And if implemented, this information would significantly reduce the number of our loved ones who ever become addicted, and also improve outcomes in treatment for those who were addicted. But the tragedy, what destroyed me, was I learned exactly what you just asked. Why wasn't this information implemented? As a father raising a family, because the brain is not fully developed till your early 20s, the hard statistics are, if a human being, on average, across 1,000 human beings, tries drugs for the first time at age 21, they're 4% likely to become addicted, 1 in 20, roughly. But if they try drugs a little bit earlier, because the brain's still developing, between 19 and 21, it's not 4% likely, it's 7% probability. Mm-hmm. If they try drugs between 15 and 17, because the brain is even less developed, it's 13% If they try drugs even earlier, it's 23%. We have the knowledge as a society. Why wasn't it implemented? Why didn't I know this as a father? Because if every parent can delay their kids from trying drugs for the first time, from delay it two or three years, instead of trying at 15, try at 17 or 18. Instead of trying at 14, try at 16 or 17. Instead of trying it at 16, try delay it to 18 or 19. Less than half of our kids, whoever would become addicted, would become addicted. Less than half.
Yeah.
Why didn't I know this as a father raising a family?
The other factor I think that is not really well known, but needs to be, is that their scientists are saying that 40 to 60% of their vulnerability is genetic.
Approximately half the country thinks that it's poor willpower, not trying hard enough. For many of the people, it's genetic. Having said that, if you could delay the age of first use by a few years, it's less likely, not fully likely, but less probable, genetically will kick in. Because it's not like genetic or not genetic, it's a range. And what you just described was a risk factor. There's several risk factors that parents should know raising their children. Age of first use, genetics, depression, anxiety, friends they hang around with. They're all risk factors. Stability of the home life. So every one of these risk factors add up. And so it's not yes or no, it's all probabilities. But if parents knew that, so many less of our children would ever become addicted.
Gary, when you first realized that Brian had a substance use disorder, what steps did you take to try to get him help?
Well, that's a two-part answer, because it's not like I never had this growing up and was not aware of anybody growing up who was addicted, quote unquote addicted. So I wasn't even used to this term substance use disorder or realized that this major issue. I was one of those, like most, that thought my son was not trying hard enough. Brian, just stop using. I didn't really understand it. And so when I first became aware there was a problem, if I could answer it that way, he was 17. He was a junior in high school. It was the last week of his junior year in high school where we got a call from the guidance counselor, said, we got a problem. Would you come in and talk to us? And he said that Brian had, they were now very suspicious that Brian was regularly smoking pot. And they would, and they had caught him in the bathroom with a half a bag of pot, and that we should pull him out and get him to treatment. And they recommended, the school psychologist recommended sending him to a wilderness program out in Utah. And we followed that advice. I now know that was the wrong advice, because there is no evidence at all that those type of programs help. There's no evidence they hurt either. And in fact, for Brian, I actually think it did help him a little bit. He was an outdoorsy kid, and I actually think it was fairly helpful for him, but there's no science that shows that on average it helps kids. But the real problem was at the end of the 8 weeks, they said he shouldn't come home. He should go to a therapeutic boarding school, and they recommended one on the north side of Atlanta. Well, and they gave us like 2 days' notice, and they sounded like professionals. You could say I'm naive. I could look back and say it's my fault for taking the advice of one place. But they said, look, we just worked with your son for 8 weeks. We think he should go to a therapeutic boarding school and continue and build upon what he's learned here out in the woods. So we took their advice. And that was the beginning of the end. Brian was there on our weekly call. He would tell us how bad it was. Who were we to believe, Brian or the program? So we believed the program, but after a year, he ran away. He called us 15 minutes later and said, "Dad, I ran away, but I'm not really running away. I just ran away from the program. I want to come home. I'm at a payphone. Please wire me the money and I will get on a bus and come home. I want to spend my senior year at home in my high school, living with you and mom. I want to be home." So I went with that. He was home that night, took a bus, and we enrolled him in the public high school again to finish his senior year. But the damage was already done. He had been at that program for a year. There was drugs smuggled in and out of this program every day. There were kids getting beat up. He met a lot of kids that turned him on to different things, and his path kept going in the wrong direction. He did fine in the public high school, but what we didn't know, he was continuing to use drugs. I mean, not in a big, bad way, but continuing. And I can go on and on, but that led to, 8 years of in and out of treatment programs.
Did you start to think at that time that maybe there was something just not quite right about this model of care?
I didn't know any difference, to be honest with you. It's easy to look back and blame myself for it was so obvious. But if you think about what I was looking at as a father, This was not part of the healthcare system. Every message point I got from anyone was Brian was not trying hard enough. There was no talk about this being an illness. And you had these 14,000 treatment programs segregated outside of the healthcare system, quote unquote rehabs. And what were you to do except listen to the professionals who were in that field? Like quote unquote professionals. There was no primary care doctor to talk to about this. They never learned about it in medical school. Even if they did learn about it, you would be ashamed to talk about it because of the shame and stigma. And there was nowhere to go to learn which treatment programs were following evidence-based practices or not. There was no credentialing program of treatment programs.
Tell us about the ways that Shatterproof is addressing that.
Sure. We have three pillars of work. Let me actually back up a couple sentences. Shatterproof was, we then formed, back to my discovery, my horrible discovery, that my son didn't have to die. Millions of others didn't have to die. We had all this great research that wasn't being utilized. And when I looked at the landscape, I saw Autism Speaks, ensuring that research in autism was getting utilized. MS Society, American Cancer Society, Susan Komen, American Heart Association. I saw nothing like that in this country for the disease of addiction. And we had all this research that existed that was not getting implemented. And the force behind implementation was a national nonprofit, well-funded, that ensured that research that had been proven to save people's lives was being implemented. And so with that, I left my business, spent 2 years building a business plan to launch a national nonprofit that would grow on the scale and scope for addiction like it had for the other diseases, like so many of our families need. And so that was the launch of Shatterproof. Our work, to your question, is in three areas. Number one, transforming the treatment system in the United States. Number two, ending the shame and stigma associated with this disease and the medications that treat it. And number three, educating families, which we've been talking about, with the information they need to raise their families in a healthy way. So, on the first part, transforming addiction treatment, five pieces to that work. Number one, we documented, published, and have gained broad industry acceptance for for the first time in our nation's history on one national standard of care for the treatment of addiction. It's on our website, it's done, it's spreading throughout the country. Number two, we built a quality measurement system to determine which treatment programs in the country are following this national standard of care and which ones are not. We raised $5 million in funding to build and pilot it and test it in six states. I'm thrilled to say Louisiana was one of those states. We're working with the leaders of your health department. And we published, after 2 years of work, it launched last July. So it's, anybody listening now to go can go to www.treatmentatlas.org, or they can find it on our website, shatterproof.org, and they can see treatment programs in the state of Louisiana and compare them side by side based on data we have of who's following evidence-based practices and who's not. We're going to be announcing in a few months that in addition to the six states that we started with, we're expanding into four others this year, so we'll be in 10, and we're already getting close to lining up states for next year as well to go beyond the 10. So it's going to spread around across the country. It's already working in the six states, including Louisiana. We have a wonderful relationship with wonderful people in the health department of Louisiana who are very supportive and our partner of this, with this. So that's number two. Standard of care was one. Quality measurement system was, or credentialing quality measurement system, number two. Number three, do patients need outpatient or residential? They don't know. I didn't know. So we work with the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which is the gold standard of researchers behind that question. And we built with a health technology firm, Open Beds, that we worked together, the three of us, for 14 months, and we developed a 13-question, less than 10-minute assessment, confidential, that anyone can take. It's on our website, and determine whether they need outpatient or residential. And then they're getting, and then only look for treatment programs that fill one of those two criteria. And we combine that with the quality measurement system. So it's all on treatmentatlas.org. The assessment, again, all confidential, and database of treatment programs show what quality each are delivering.
Gary, when you talk about a national standard of care, what would that standard of care look like?
It's on our website. There's eight principles of care. It's things like, do you assess someone not just for substance use disorder, but also mental health issues and physical issues? That's, you know, like really important, because many treatment programs aren't doing that. They're just assessing for addiction. But if they don't also assess for anxiety or depression or any other mental health issues, you're not seeing the full picture. You're not treating the patient for the full picture. Another key item is continually assessing and continually modifying care based on that assessment. If you get treated for, if one of the three of us had chest pains tonight, you go to the emergency room, they put you through a battery of tests and you would get assessed. They wouldn't tell you what your treatment is for the next 6 months. They would tell you it is for the next week, and then they'd assess you, probably, and they'd assess you a day later and adjust it slightly, and a day later and adjust it slightly. Many treatment programs, you go, and this is your program for 28 days. Well, one size fits all. Could you imagine treating all cancers the same way?
No.
Or not adjusting care? But that's not typically done. Or let me say typically, and sometimes it's not. So you need to assess for that. You need to assess for, do they offer medications to treat someone who's addicted to opioids? There's certain medications, alcohol, there's certain medications. If you're addicted to one of those, does that program offer, fully explain those medications? Doesn't mean every patient has to take them, but just like with heart disease, if I had that assessment after a couple days, I would sit with a doctor and they would say, bad news, you got a bad heart valve. Good news, we can talk about three ways to treat it. You could take medication. Here's the pluses, here's the minuses. You can have an operation. Here's the pluses, here's the minuses. You could do nothing for a month and let's see how it goes. Here's the pluses and minuses. That's how you should be treated for substance use disorder. You are addicted to opioids. That's the bad news. You have no mental health issues. That's the good news. Here are some different ways to treat it. You can treat it this way. You could try medication. You could try it without medication for a month and see how it goes. You could try it. You can go to a treatment program. You could not. Pluses and minuses of each, fully explained. What behavioral therapies do you offer? There's seven that are listed in the Surgeon General's report that have multiple studies showing they improve outcomes. Do you, which one of these seven do you offer? Things like that.
I'm just wondering how the medical community reacted. Are they grateful to have some tools and handles, or
Absolutely. They reacted wonderfully because we drafted these seven principles, these eight principles of care. We pulled them from, first of all, we worked alongside the lead author of the Surgeon General's report and Pew Charitable Trusts. And we pulled from the Surgeon General's report information in there that had been reviewed by every federal agency that relates to health in the United States and 200 researchers. No one could argue with anything we had in there. No one. It was so well researched and documented.
You're also working on some legislative items as well, aren't you?
Correct. So I mentioned five things to transforming the treatment system: standard of care, quality measurement, assessment whether you need inpatient or outpatient, and whether you need mental health services or what medications you need. Number four, policy work that you just mentioned, payment models. Working with state Medicaid office to adopt a code that was adopted by the federal government years ago that facilitate quality care, where they pay for an entire episode of care, not just isolated instances. And it's been proven through multiple studies to significantly improve the health of patients when doctors bill and treat off this billing code. And only 14 states, up until a few months ago, had adopted these codes. We're thrilled to say that we work with the state of California. They have just adopted them, and we're working in many states right now. We're working in a dozen states right now to get them to adopt these codes and have doctors start using them and billing off it and treating accordance to these codes. The other thing we're working on is a national bill to require all medical professionals who have a DEA license to prescribe controlled substances to have a basic information on the prevention and treatment of addiction. Every medical student graduates medical school with a basic understanding of how the body works. Not specialty, but a basic understanding. And if you want to specialize in that area, you get a residency and a fellowship. It should be the same way with addiction. And we have a bill in Congress right now that would effectuate that, that we're working really hard to get signed into law. And then we move on to our second pillar of work, stigma. And to me, this is the bigger killer. You know, half of Americans think those who are addicted to drugs or alcohol, not their fault, it's a chronic illness. Half think it is their fault, they're not trying hard enough. But 80%, which include many who believe it's a chronic illness, say, I'm not comfortable associating with someone addicted as my friend, my coworker, my neighbor, marrying into my family. Why do they believe that? Why aren't they comfortable? Because no one thinks it's a treatable disease, but it is. 50% of emergency room and primary care doctors don't believe it's a treated disease. 1 in 2 doctors, because they're not taught in medical school and they don't think it's treatable. The data shows if patients are treated with our principles of care that are all documented in the Surgeon General's report, success rates are the same as someone being treated for diabetes or heart disease or chronic heart disease or asthma.
Do you think the stigma associated with drug addiction actually hinders people from seeking treatment?
I don't think it, I know it. There's an annual survey by the federal government. Only about 15% of the people who were have a substance use disorder or addicted go to treatment, compared to 88% for diabetes, 75% for heart disease. Why a big gap? Some of that gap is documented in the government's annual survey, where 20% of those with a substance use disorder said, I am not seeking treatment. 20%, because I don't want my friends or coworkers to find out. Why? They haven't read that survey that I just mentioned, but they feel it. And can you imagine? You're 20 years old. You became addicted to Vicodin. It turned into Oxycontin. It turned into heroin. You don't want anybody to know, because you sense if people know, they're not going to want anything to do with you. Your parents find out. They convince you to go to treatment. You can't find a provider. One quarter of primary care doctors have stated the reason they will not treat people addicted to opioids is they think it might create a bad perception on their practice. But let's say you get through all those hurdles. Your parents talk to you into go, you find a provider, you go to treatment, and you went to the best treatment program in the country, doing all the right things. You still enter a society where 80% of Americans don't want to associate with you. How does that make you feel? My son woke up one morning, researched suicide notes, wrote a note of his own, and took his own life. And he hadn't used a substance in 13 months. Why? Because he wrote about it in his suicide note. Shame, stigmatized, having everybody look at him like he's a bad kid. We spent a year studying all the literature that existed, all the research on how do you change knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors, i.e. stigma, related to this disease. And we have built content to deliver to stakeholders in our country that has been proven to change the way that people think about this. We have a state-based campaign designed. And I'm pleased to say our first state is the state of Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania had partnered with us to do this. We spent all last summer getting ready for it in the state. We launched a campaign in September, and we just did our 6-month review, and enormous changes in the way that society thinks about this disease. Just to give you a sample, after 6 months, we just did a resurvey of the population. Those who had not seen our content, the campaign, you know, would you be willing to have a person with an opiate use disorder as my neighbor? Those who had not seen the campaign, 38%. Those who had seen the campaign, 50%. Opiate addiction is a medical illness like diabetes, arthritis, or heart disease. Those who had not seen the campaign, 58%. Those who had, 66%. This is only 5.5 months. And in 5.5 months, we reached 3 million people in Pennsylvania. 3 million people, one quarter of the population of Pennsylvania. So if any of your listeners are related to the state and want us to do it and we implement this in Louisiana, please reach out to me. We'd love to talk to you because we would love to form a group partnership with the state and do this in other states, including Louisiana for sure. And we've also developed content for companies. We've developed content for the criminal justice system. We've developed content for the media and entertainment. We have content for each stakeholders, and we're just getting off the ground, getting this going. Pennsylvania is the first big campaign we're doing. But we have the design for companies, for states, for different sectors of our society, and providers. We have a content all ready to go, to your question, for providers that we partnered with Dell Medical School out of Texas, and we built the content. It's ready to go. In fact, we're going to be piloting that in Pennsylvania as well.
Do you have plans on rolling anything out in Texas anytime soon? We have listeners in Texas and Arkansas and Mississippi.
Well, we are talking to Texas right now as we speak to be one of the states that we expand our quality measurement system into. And anybody interested in helping us reach out, you know, we're working with the state, but the more people who live in the state who can say we want this, the better. So anybody interested in Texas, let us know. in what other states did you mention besides Louisiana?
Arkansas and Mississippi.
Mississippi, there was a presentation made to the Attorney General's office a couple days ago about the stigma campaign that we're doing in Pennsylvania. So we're waiting to hear back. But Texas is a, we're all really interested in Texas because of the size of the state, obviously, and the number of people we can help. And we're talking to the health department now, but we can use more people who live in the state working with us to say to the health department, we want this.
We also have, we live stream, so we have loyal listeners all over the country and world.
Wonderful, wonderful. Anybody interested in either of these programs for your state, the quality measurement system or the stigma reduction program, please reach out to Shatterproof, you know, on our contact line and tell your interest and it'll get to me and we'll be in touch. You know, and the last piece of what we do is information for families that I didn't have. We all know that there are millions of pages of words that are out there. We spent a year and a half curating down all the information that is out there into six lessons of 5 minutes each. It's called Just Five. You can find information about it on our website. And anybody interested, just reach out to the information on our website and we'll schedule a demo. We would like to get that to schools, to companies. I mean, JP Morgan Chase is doing it for all their employees. We're announcing one of the largest cities in the country is going to do it for all their employees. We'll be announcing that next month. We're announcing one of the largest states in the country is going to be announcing for all their state employees in 2 months. They're going to be announcing it. We've got 30 companies using it right now for their employees. It's really the three, and it includes a lot of prevention information. It includes that information about age of first use. It's all in there. And so when you ask, why didn't I know this? Well, we have it now, and we're getting it out. So anybody interested, it's all on our website, on our programs, where anyone can, if any questions, just reach out to our info line.
Gary, I wanted to ask you, as far as the Atlas resource site, which facilities are included there and how do you select those facilities?
We work with the state and they give us a list of all licensed facilities and every facility is listed. Now, when someone searches, it will only the facilities that gave us data that we needed to evaluate them will show up, but they're all there. And every treatment program in the state that's licensed has a webpage that we created for them with information about them. But if they didn't give us the data we needed to evaluate if they're how they're delivering on evidence-based practices, then that doesn't show up in a list that pops up when someone searches. But it's all there. Every treatment program has a page.
And as well as it being a resource for people who may have an addiction problem or families of people who may have an addiction problem. It also is a resource for providers and payers as well. Could you explain that to us a little?
The two of you have wonderful questions. Yes, we in addition to the sites that is available to families, we also want to use it to change the entire treatment system. And to do that, to change the entire treatment system, one of the ways is the consumer site. So if treatment programs know that families are going there to pick where they're going to send their son or daughter or mother or father or brother or sister, well, they're going to start making sure they follow these evidence-based practices or people will stop attending their treatment program. We also have a password-protected site for insurance companies, for payers. So they can go there and use this information and we're formatting it in different ways that are user-friendly to them to figure out which treatment programs they should put in their networks and which ones they shouldn't. And this will shift demand to the higher quality treatment programs. We also have a separate password protected site for treatment programs. Give the information to them so they can see how do they compare to the average. They can see which areas they're good, which areas they're weak, so they can learn. And we're also taking that information and where treatment programs are not doing as well, we're providing quarterly seminars and teaching them and helping them and giving them resources. We're not here to rate providers. We're here to help providers. Most providers are really wonderful people who want to do the right things. And we also have a password protected site for states. So states can see how do their treatment programs compare to other states on average. And if they see they're low in an area, it may be because of a policy that was passed 10 years ago. They don't realize that it's hurting things. And they can identify where the issues are. And they can figure out which treatment programs are following evidence-based practices. Those are the ones Medicaid should contract with, and the other ones they shouldn't. So it's all there.
Gary, I know we talked about Brian's problem with addiction, but that's not his entire story. Could you tell us the beautiful things about Brian, what he was like as a boy growing up?
That's your better question. They continue. I mean, Renee, thank you. I mean, he was every father's dream. He was my firstborn son. You know, as a baby, he was just as smiley, always hugging me, just, you know, my best friend, always at my side. As he grew a little older, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, he was, you know, like a, you know, a typical kid. He loved his little trucks. He'd line them up around his room and play with his little trucks. He would chase butterflies in the backyard. He was a horrible outfielder on Little League because all he cared about was chasing butterflies instead of watching for the ball. And then as he grew and went to a teenager, he did many of the things that teenagers do. One of them, trying alcohol for the first time or pot at 13, 14, or 15. I don't know exactly. I think it was just before he turned 14, but I don't know exactly. But if I had known that age of first use was such a huge determinant, maybe I could have delayed that 2 or 3 years till he was 16 or 17, not 13 or 14. And that could have made a difference. If I had known about evidence, but if he became addicted, and if I had known about what evidence-based treatment was, and what protocol should be followed, I mean, and all that he felt, that most people wanted nothing to do with him. If I had known all this, maybe there could have been a difference. And you know what? This is not just about, I appreciate Renee asking about Brian, but I know what Brian would want me to be doing right now. Not be thinking about him, but thinking about, because of what happened to him and what I learned thereafter, using that to help others. And he's here in my heart right now. And together, we are building a movement to take the information that our government has funded, sitting there unused, and get it out there. Get people using it. Get them the information to choose the right treatment program. Change laws, payment policies, so if this helps treatment programs do the right things. Get rid of all this shame and stigma, because this is a treatable disease, just like any other chronic illness. And give information to families through Just Five that they need, the education program. It's 6 lessons of 5 minutes each. It's 30 minutes. It's what you need to know as a family, both preventatively and how to understand the treatment system. And if you need more, you scroll down, you get all you want. But if you don't have any issues, it's 30 minutes of 5 minutes each.
I know there's a ton of data out there, but do you have any data on like economic groups? You know, is it more prevalent in wealthier or poorer? I know it's no respecter of persons, but.
No, sure. When I really studied this deeply and back in 2012, there was no big difference. Lately, the data is showing that people of color are being hit disproportionately. This makes this even more important for health equity reasons. And that's why we are working to over address that. For example, on the quality measurement system, which is up and running in Louisiana today, the team doesn't know it yet. We're going to be surprising them with some good news, is that we're converting it to Spanish. We got funding to do so, and it will be convertible to Spanish in about 45 days. And then once that's up and running, we get out any tweaks, we're going to spread it to other languages. Because why, if you don't speak English, you shouldn't have the same information as everybody else? Mm-hmm. And we're looking at other ways of making sure that there's health equity here, that everyone gets the same information. We just converted Just Five to Spanish as well. That's done. So any, and that's when it's launching in one a major city, they're launching both versions, the Spanish version and the English version. And we're going to be also looking at other languages for that one as well, but that's already done.
That's great. Gary, if someone wants to volunteer for Shatterproof or help financially, how can they do so?
Sure. On our website, there's one of the top links is for get involved. And you just hit that button and there's a variety of ways to get involved. To be an advocate, to be an ambassador, which is a volunteer. And then you fill out a very simple, in seconds application, and then you'll connect with our volunteer manager. So she understands your interests. There's a variety of ways. You can do fundraisers, you can donate, you can become an ambassador, you could volunteer to do podcasts like this as a volunteer. A strong thing for a volunteer is we've heard about these programs. Let's get these programs into your state. We need more and more volunteers that help us do that, the faster we can grow. The faster we can save people's lives.
Just one last question here. Do you partner with people like with AA or any of those groups?
We partner with just about any organization in the field. Most often with policy change. Because when we go into a state and we want to get a specific policy changed, we network and find all the local organizations that we can that want to partner with us to go to state officials to get a policy changed. I would say that the only thing that we're particular to NA or AA is the last A. It's the anonymous. Anonymous creates shame and stigma. Anything you say between you and your doctor, just like any disease, is confidential. But you shouldn't be ashamed. You say you have diabetes, heart disease, cancer, substance use disorder. If you're afraid to tell people why, are you ashamed? How does that feel? How does it feel? I always wondered, I never asked Brian about this, but how did he feel the last 6 or 7 years of his life? He was not Brian Mendel anymore. He was Brian M. Did he ever think about that subconsciously? Mm-hmm. But for policy change, we work with any organization that wants to work with us that aligns with our policy work.
Great.
Let's make our families shatterproof. No more shattering of families.
It's been very good to talk with you. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you. Thank you both so much. Renee and Deanne, thank you both.
We've just talked with Gary Mendel of Shatterproof, and now we are joined by Dr. Sean McNeil, Clinical Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at LSU Health Shreveport and President-elect of the Louisiana Psychiatric Medical Association. Sean, thank you for joining us today.
All right, it's a pleasure.
Dr. McNeil, the CDC and the NIDA both say that addiction is 40 to 60% genetics and that the younger someone is when they first try a substance, the more likely they are to become addicted. And so I'm wondering if this science is informing today's treatments, and if so, how?
Well, it does. And we do see patterns, of use in family, not just in families, but, in communities. I think the people that you associate with has a lot to do with what drugs you might end up using. But there's certainly a genetic component. And, we do see that a lot of patients that come in with substance use disorders have a family history, and sometimes have a history of other psychiatric problems or maybe even abuse. So I think it's something that we, of course, we note, but we're also usually just treating the patient, not necessarily treating the whole family. So currently, I don't know that we use much genetic information in the treatment of addiction, but that might be an area of future research where we can actually use a person's genetics to help them get better.
So Sean, what are some of the most common addictions that you see in people in our area?
So for this area, we do see a lot of alcohol use disorder. We see a lot of stimulants being used. Methamphetamines have taken over. I think, you know, cocaine is still there, but meth seems to be a bigger problem currently. And I don't know if this is just seasonal or if this is just a new trend that we're seeing. There's still some opiate and benzodiazepine use that we see, but I would say the stimulants are the more common one that I see. Now, I'm biased because I work in psychiatry, so I get to see the patients that present with psychiatric symptoms. So, you know, unless the drug produces psychiatric symptoms, you know, we don't see it as often. So, for example, cannabis use disorder, we don't usually see that as the primary reason that a person comes into the hospital. Now, sometimes it produces some psychiatric symptoms, but typically the symptoms aren't as severe as, say, stimulant use disorder. People using methamphetamines, they might present with more severe psychiatric symptoms that lead to them coming into a psychiatric ER and the psychiatric hospital.
So today they are using more drugs to treat substance use disorder?
There's more available now than it used to be. Most of the FDA approved medications are geared towards alcohol use disorder, but we are starting to get more options. So I'm just going to give one example. There's a medicine called naltrexone, which can also be used for alcohol use disorder, but it's also FDA approved for opioid use disorder to reduce cravings. Now that's a medicine that itself doesn't have any addictive potential. There are other medicines that we use, like methadone and Suboxone, that we can give people who have an opioid addiction, and it's kind of helps them because it's more regulated, so it's safer for them to be on a medicine like methadone or Suboxone, you know, versus an opioid.
So how does prescription drug abuse begin, and what are some of the signs that someone could be abusing their prescriptions?
It can begin, I mean, it's very hard to tell who might develop an addiction to a medication. And typically, the most commonly prescribed medicines that people get addicted to are probably opioids, like pain medications, or benzodiazepines, which are usually used for anxiety, sometimes used for sleep.
Is that like Xanax, benzo?
Yeah, that's an example. Xanax, the other name for it is alprazolam. There's diazepam or Valium. There's clonazepam or Clonopin. Those are just some examples. There's quite a few more in that same category, but those are some of the more commonly used ones. So, you know, as a provider, we're looking for signs that they might be either taking too much of their medication. So like they might run out early. And so they sometimes ask for their prescription, you know, earlier and earlier each month. So that can be a sign. We actually have it's called the PMP, it's for prescription monitoring, and each state has one. And we can check to see what controlled substances are being prescribed to a patient. And so we can log on there and see if perhaps they're getting controlled substances filled from multiple providers or maybe in multiple different states. That might be a red flag. And we're looking at the combinations of medicines that these patients are taking. Sometimes, you know, they're taking medications that are really not, they really shouldn't be taken together. And that's really partly our clinical judgment, but usually, you know, when you see multiple classes of controlled medicines being given at the same time, that's often a red flag, and that should raise some suspicion and make the clinician want to look deeper into it.
What about cognitive behavior therapy? Is that generally in use these days?
So CBT is a very common form of therapy, and it can be used for a lot of different conditions. When it comes to addiction or substance addiction specifically, sometimes we might start out with motivational interviewing. That's a commonly used modality. Some types of group therapies are pretty commonly used, but CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy is also, you know, very useful. Now there's a whole class of addictions that don't involve substances, but they're more behavioral addictions. And just to give you an example, gambling addiction or, you know, pornography addiction or something like that. You know, it's not, you're not taking a substance into your body, but it's more behavioral in nature. And so there might be a greater role for a therapy like CBT when it comes to those behavioral addictions.
So Sean, how can addiction affect families?
Well, an addiction can be very consuming. It can take over a person's life. If it's, you know, the leader of the family, they might use the family's resources on obtaining substances, and that leaves very little left for the family, and it can tear families apart. And it's not just financial. I mean, there can be abuse involved. I mean, if someone's intoxicated all the time, it really affects the relationships, and it can affect how they treat the other people in the household, including, you know, vulnerable people like children or the elderly. And so it can have a profound impact on the family.
So how can parents perhaps help their child who may have an addiction problem?
So that can be a challenge. You know, if the child is under 18, the parents have a lot more say-so over the treatment. But once the child turns 18, a lot of the treatments for addiction are voluntary. So the adult child, we'll call them, does need to be agreeable. Sometimes if the legal system is involved, the patient or the person can, instead of going to jail, they can go through a drug court, and they can have mandated treatment. And so the family can be a part of that process, you know, as far as getting them help. But it can be a challenge. It can be a challenge seeking out the help and making them take part in a program.
The stigma of addiction has been tied to relapse and other problems. And I'm wondering what your opinion is on how we as a society, we can reverse that.
I think you're right. And there's a stigma there, and the stigma may be decreasing over time, but it's probably not going to go away overnight. So the best thing that we can do is make it more of a normal thing to get help when you need help. And of course, making the help readily available is part of that. Making sure that every community has some options for a person to take part in. But, you know, I think that the media can be very critical in letting people know that there are options out there in the community.
So what should someone look for when they're seeking a treatment facility?
You know, really, it depends on the person's mindset. You know, if they're ready for change, they're going to be a lot more able to take part in the treatment, and they're going to be a lot more receptive, you know, for the help that they're going to receive. So I think it depends more on the person rather than the program. But there are a variety of programs out there. So there's inpatient rehabilitation where you go and it's residential. You might stay there for 28 days. I've heard of some of them being longer, like maybe two or three months. Then there are shorter programs like intensive outpatient programs. You might still live at your home, but you might go attend the program, you know, several days a week. And it might be like a full day program. And then there are less restrictive programs like Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. And you might go, you know, just for shorter meetings, and you choose how often you want to go. Some people go every single day. And some people go less often, they go once a week. It's really up to the person, unless a court is involved or unless they're being forced from some external source, you know, it's really up to the person how much treatment they want to receive.
After someone does seek treatment, how important is support afterwards, and what should that support look like?
Well, yeah, support is critical. When a patient is discharged with not much support, it's very easy to return to using, especially if they were using to self-medicate. You know, they might have some of the same problems. They might be around some of the same people in the same neighborhoods where they're, you know, the drugs are accessible, and it's very easy to get back on the horse, you know, get back on the addiction horse. But having family support or community support is very critical, making sure they take the right steps to get themselves out of a negative environment, out of you know, a drug infested area, I think it's pretty important. So the person is not always able to make a decision like that. Sometimes they have no choice but to go back to a bad community. So I think it's just that much more critical that they're involved in a very regimented rehab program after they're discharged from either a psychiatric unit or discharged from like a residential rehab. They need to make sure that they have a support system in place. And Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous try to create that support through sponsor, you know, having a sponsor. That's one kind of baked in way of making sure that there's some support involved.
We kind of live in a tough love, throw them in jail mentality. What can we do to make treatment more effective, and what laws need to be addressed, do you think?
And addiction shouldn't be criminalized. I mean, there are cases where someone really did break the law and they need punishment, and that's, you know, it's up to the court system to determine that. And again, sometimes there are these diversion programs like drug court that give them opportunities for rehabilitation rather than just serving time. It's a problem. It's a very big problem that probably needs to be solved. But I think it starts with education, you know, educating the community that addiction is a real problem, educating the patients that they have, you know, a real disorder. I mean, addiction is a real disorder. We call it substance use disorder. If you let them know that it's real and that there is really help out there, it makes it more likely that they would see it that way and maybe engage in treatment.
Sean, what are some of the reasons someone may be reluctant to seek help? And how would you encourage someone to decide to get help?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the stigma. That's one part of it. Some people are afraid of getting locked in a hospital. You know, they're afraid that they might show up and they might have to stay. So they might not seek help at all because of that. So I think, you know, the best way to engage them is, you know, maybe community outreach. I think that more community-based programs to help with addiction, that could be helpful. And that would start to erode some of that stigma, you know, when as these treatment programs start really reaching out to the community, as you start to see more success stories. You know, if someone you know was able to get off drugs, I think that might make it more likely that you would choose to engage in treatment and maybe more likely for you to stick with it when you've seen the results.
We have been joined today by Dr. Sean McNeil. Sean, thank you so much for being here today on Eliminations.
All right, thank you.
Once again, I'm Renee Moran, and my co-host is Deanne Phillips. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for About Faith with Dr. Marcy Howard, and join us again in 2 weeks for another episode of Eliminations. Views and opinions expressed on Eliminations do not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or staff.